Accession number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 11. Now, we're talking about our typical flight, daytime mainly, but, you know, over the Ruhr, normally bombing synthetic fuel units. And we got on to the return flight. Now, I just wanted to pick up a couple of points that I'd omitted. Yeah. One is, can you give us an idea of what the physical environment of the aircraft was like, in the sense of the smells, the noise, the sound, you know, what was it like in there?
Well, the most prominent feature, I think, was the noise. Unless you've sat between four Merlin, in the middle of four Merlin engines at full blast, you just don't realise the enormous noise that vibrates through the aircraft. The pilot and engineer are virtually in line with the engines, and they are truly horrific. And then there's vibration from the engines while they're running. The aircraft is vibrating. The aircraft sometimes is too hot and sometimes it's too cold. It's rarely just as you would like it. The systems for heating were old-fashioned, didn't operate always. So that apart from the electrically heated suits for the gunners, people were either too hot, too cold. There was not so much smell in the aircraft because air was passing through it all the time. I mean, aircraft leak air. Windows are never tight shut, or the sliding windows at the side. There's always air passing through the aircraft. So that there's not that much smell, but there is an enormous amount of noise, and almost claustrophobic, of course, because one is strapped into a seat. One can't move except from arms and legs, lean forward a little bit. And turn your head from side to side. Well, the engineer normally stood in my aircraft. He had a let-down seat. But he was very busy, paying attention to engine conditions and the fuel conditions. I think the bomb aimer probably had the most pleasant ride because in the front of the aircraft, you didn't get the engine noise. It was swept to the rear. It was more spacious. And apart from the fact he might get a lot of flak up below him or he could see something happening, he had probably the best position in the aircraft in terms of comfort.
Now, one thing about comfort is latrines, toilet. I mean, there was an L-SAN, wasn't there? Would people use the L-SAN?
They may have done, but our crew never used it. You can't just go and sit on the bog at the back of an aircraft when you're sort of on operations. It's just not possible. You just wouldn't want to do it. There might be a mishap, but certainly you wouldn't want to go down in the back. I never got out of my seat from takeoff to landing.
Now, this brings us back to a story which you told me yesterday in the car about the Wellington.
Yes.
It's an indelicate
story.
It does actually illustrate the problems that Wellington pilots had. So we would like to hear it in all its gory detail.
Yes. Well, this occurred towards the end of a 5 or 6 hour bullseye or cross country or sunset trip. In the last hour, I really desperately wanted to pee. But being clad in a large, heavy Sidcot suit over a padded, quilted inner liner with a battle dress under that, Y fronts under that, it was virtually impossible to do anything. There was a sort of cup contraption provided, which, providing you could manage it, you could pee into, but it just wasn't possible. At least it wasn't possible for me. And on this particular occasion, we were letting down quite fast towards the airfield. It was at night. And my bomb aimer had started to come out of the forward position to get to the rear for landing. And he was clambering up. And I suddenly felt, I just cannot hold my water any longer. I'm going to pee my pants. So I managed to unbuckle and unzip and get things to the point where I could point Percy at the porcelain, as the Aussies say, and I duly let fly past the control column towards the bomb aimer's compartment. Just at that position, there is a hot air blower which at this time was blowing cold air, and blowing it down towards the bomb aimer's position. So as he clambered out of his position, he was suddenly met by a spray of pee from his pilot, and his language was something to be believed. And he got it across his, it was in his moustache, it was in his oxygen mask, which was dangling, and he wasn't best pleased. But I felt relieved.
Now, back to the Wellington. We're flying home. Anything else about
the Lancaster?
Yes. Back to the Lancaster. Flying home.
Flying home on those daylight formation rays was fairly straightforward. There were a different course or track to fly it back. And the group stayed in group formation probably for the first 100 miles or so, whereupon the squadrons, which had all come from separate airfields, diverted towards their own airfield rather than stay in group formation.
Now, before we go on, I've just remembered another thing. One is that your use of these little maps, that you had your pilot's map.
Yes.
Now, you were a great believer in this, and we had a look at one, and it is noted up exactly as you say. Now, you'd actually use this in flight to check on the navigate, to check on everything, really.
I always like to be prepared for any thing that might happen. So I use the map mainly as a, not so much to check that the navigator was doing his job, but if a turn was coming up, I was expecting it. So if I knew that in 5 minutes' time, I would be expecting to turn. If I didn't get that turn from the navigator, I would say, when are we going to turn? Which would jog his memory if he'd forgotten. It's unlikely, but it was a sort of aide memoir to me that this is what we should be doing. Here's the plan. It's set out there. I can see where we should be. And if we aren't there, I'm going to ask the questions. So I knew exactly what was happening or what would be happening ahead rather than what had happened. I could see that we should be turning to starboard or to port. We should be letting down. We should be climbing. We should increase or decrease airspeed for some reason or other. And it was a sort of little, if you like, a prompt to the navigator. You know, you haven't forgotten we've got to turn off soon or something like that. I found them most helpful. I'm not sure how other pilots use them. I expect they did roughly the same.
Now, the squadrons have started to split up to return to their bases.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the big formations splitting into squadron formations.
Yes.
What's the approach procedure? You know, what is the landing general procedure from start to finish?
Well, in a daylight with, say, upwards of 20 aircraft all approaching an airfield roughly at the same time because we'd all been in formation, there were certain people who would pile on the coals, as it were, and dive down as fast as they could to be first in to land. I didn't bother too much because unless one was first, you still have to wait and circle till your turn to land. And what one did, one came in and called up the field, and they would give you a height to circle the airfield, usually at 500 or 600 feet separation. So the first guy that called up was told to enter the circuit and proceed on landing. The second aircraft was told to join the circuit at 500 feet above that height, and so on, so that eventually you've got most of the squadron aircraft circling the airfield, waiting their turn to drop down. And as one aircraft landed, everyone dropped down the requisite 500 feet until the last one was on the approach and landed. It was a well-organized, simple system, and it was fairly easy to do in daylight.
And what was the landing drill as a pilot? I mean, how did you actually physically...
One joined the circuit, and the important part of the circuit was the downwind sector, which was parallel to the runway one was going to land on, but in a downwind sense, i.e. in the wrong direction. And during that point, one lowered a certain amount of flap, slowed the aircraft down, and lowered the landing wheels. At the end of that part of the circuit, a crosswind turn was made. Most RAF aircraft and airfields operated a left-hand circuit, so we turned to port and went across towards the runway threshold. And then as one got opposite the, or just before he got opposite to the approach runway, one turned in towards the runway, letting down all the time, so that by the time we were on what we called the finals, and we were approaching the runway in our glide position, we would be at 500 feet, and then we would go straight ahead, gradually lowering to about 50 to 100 feet over the threshold, and then proceed to land the aircraft.
And land
on landing, one rolled out to the end of the runway and either taxied left or right towards our dispersals. Again, we tried to keep radio activity, wireless activity, to a minimum. So there were just terse, there was not, okay, old boy, I've got it, and things like that. It was just, Wilco, Roger, and that's all one heard.
So you taxi to your dispersal.
Yes.
Would it be the same one you'd left? I mean, would you park
yes,
it exactly
you'd
where
park
it?
Yes, that's right. One go back, and the ground crew would be waiting, and they'd have a baton in each hand, and you turned into the little entrance to the, we called them pans. They were a circle of tarmac or concrete, and then he would guide you into that, and then holding one vertically, he would circle his arm in the other way so that you'd gradually turn around until you were facing in generally into wind. This was the way you left an aircraft, facing into the prevailing winds. And the ground crew would put the chocks under the wheels and we would shut down the motors and the crew would disembark.
Any final checks before you got out? You know, you had these checks when you get on. Would you check anything before you got out?
The last thing the pilot would do would be open the bomb doors. One thing that the ground crew didn't like to have to do was to pump down by hand these enormous bomb bay doors. So it was sort of etiquette. As soon as the aircraft stopped, you opened the bomb bay doors so that the ground crew had access to it. You tried to lessen their workload, if you like.
Because you could use the power, whereas they couldn't.
Yes, yes. Well, the power was in the aircraft to open the bomb bay doors, but once the engines were set down, they, you know, they wouldn't start engines to lower a bomb bay. They had to hand pump it down, and you know, they didn't like this.
Now, so what would happen then? So you let them open the bomb bay doors,
yep.
Power down.
Yeah, the ground crew would swarm around. They start putting wheel covers on. The senior member, he'd be a corporal or sergeant, would be at the rear of the aircraft, and he'd ask you if you've got any defects, any problems. And you might report that one of the engines is running rather high, the temperatures were high, or that there was a misbeat, or the prop wasn't working properly. And you'd sign a form, which he provided you with, to say that these are the defects, or there are no defects. You sign a form before you take off, Form 700, so you've accepted the aircraft in perfect condition. And when you land, you sign off again saying there's nothing wrong or there might be the odd defects.
Now, then what? So you've signed off.
Okay. Then we would wait. Some of the crew would have a fag. But we'd wait for transport to be sent to us. And bear in mind there are probably only about three or four lorries available or buses. And all the crews were landing. We often waited there 20 or 30 minutes. And then we'd go back to the squadron offices or the briefing rooms, and where we would individually, each crew would be debriefed by an operations officer or intelligence officer.
Now, what was the nature of this debriefing?
Well, one sat at a table, probably had a cup of tea or mug of coffee or cocoa. Fags were lit. And the intelligence officer said, well, how did it go? And you'd just say, oh, fine. He'd say, well, what? And then he'd start asking a series of questions about were the cloud conditions as forecast or were they not? Were the winds as forecast or not? And the appropriate person in the crew, myself or the navigator, would answer yes or no or maybe. They would ask if we saw any fighters. They would ask if we saw any other activities such as vertical contrails, meaning a V2 had taken off over Holland, and we did see those on occasions. they would ask about any fighter opposition, what the flak conditions were like. Did you observe your bombs actually strike the ground? This would be to the bomb aim, and he'd say, well, not actually, because a cloud drifted across. Or, yes, I think we hit it dead on the nail. Of course, we probably didn't, but he always claimed he hit it dead on the nail.
Did they, I should have asked, did they take a photograph?
Yes, photographs are always taken day and night of the times after the release of the bomb, so that there were photographs which, once developed, would explain just where the bombs had landed. They couldn't always say, well, those bomb bursts down there were from this particular aircraft, but they got a fairly good picture. What they could do, and this was more often at night, they could see if crews were releasing their bombs much too early to get out of it. Of course, if the target indicators weren't in view when you bombed, you just weren't there.
Anything else about this debriefing?
Well, not too much. It would take anything up between 5 minutes and a quarter of an hour, depending on what one had to report. And then one could disperse back to, well, we handed in the parachutes. Took flying clothing off, and that would go back to the flight office with you. And you could go back to the billets or go to the mess for a meal. There was a meal provided if you wanted it. And it, you know, there was this traditional eggs and bacon thing that didn't always happen. But
was that important or not, the crew? Cause some people go on about the crew. Yeah. I think eggs were scarce.
Well, they were scarce, but it didn't seem, I didn't particularly worry whether I had them or not. We never sat down as a crew. I mean, what happened was that on our squadron anyway, a meal such as it was would be provided in the officer's mess and another one in the sergeant's mess. So we, you know, as a crew, we couldn't get together and have breakfast at Tiffany's.
And as you were crew orientated, it wasn't important to you then?
No, it wasn't. I didn't want to be split up, but we'd find out, you know, sooner or later whether we could get off the station and go into town.
Now, what we're going to do now is look at some of the raids you want. That was a typical raid, which of course
yes, that was
really
a typical
exist.
Average.
Yeah. So now we'll just look at some of the ones that happened. It looks like your first raid was on the 14th of March when you went over Heinrichshütte with the 14,000 and 12,500.
Yeah.
Anything about that, your first raid? I mean, was there anything particular about it?
No. As far as I'm concerned, it was completely routine. It had been described to me what it was like by odd persons. I thought I knew what to expect. It went as I expected. It was very much routine.
Then ones following it, you know, the 17th and 20th of the same month, on over Hulse and over Ham.
Yeah.
Anything in particular about it? It's just, you know, only if there's something to report other than...
There was nothing really. I can't remember anything really untoward in any particular flight. There may have been the odd thing, but I can't recollect them now.
One of the bombs hung up, I think the 4,000 bomb over Ham.
Yeah.
Does that stick in your mind at all?
Well, not really. It was just, you know, it was a thing that happened and what one did. Often the release mechanism was iced up, and it meant that when you came down to lower altitude and the air warmed up, the ice would melt and the bomb would drop, it being fired, the bomb would drop into the bomb bay, which meant you had to get rid of it in any case. So usually this was done over the sea on the return trip. We always had to pass over some sea to get back to the UK. So any hang-ups were dropped in the sea from a safe height. You didn't sort of fly down low because you could be damaged in the blast. But if you had a hangar, I mean, I know that some guys would sort of shake the aircraft about whilst they were still over enemy-held territory in the hopes it would do a bit more damage, but we didn't.
Now, air tests. There's not many air tests down here.
No.
I just found one. Air test and air firing on the 5th of April.
Yes.
What was an air test, and was it important, or what was the purpose of it?
Well, usually it was carried out if an aircraft had had the odd defect or had an engine change or a new aileron put on or something like that. And an air test then was carried out by the particular crew to ensure that the aircraft was functioning correctly. In the case of the air-to-air firing, this was done with live ammunition, and we would have an aircraft towing a drogue target, and we would contact it in the air, and they would come in, and then they would fly alongside or come alongside, and the gunners in turn would fire at the target.
Now, when they're in red, are they the night operations?
Yes. Days are in green, and
there are two night operations. I don't know which you remember better. I mean, we're not going to go through the whole thing, obviously.
No, quite.
But one's over Kiel on the 9th of April, and the other one, I think you do remember, is on the 14th of April over Potsdam. I don't know which you remember better.
I remember Kiel anyway because we sunk, a German heavy cruiser was sunk, overturned in Kiel Harbour. But the Potsdam was a good trip.
What do you remember about that? I mean,
well, it was a lot of flak because it was a naval port, and German guns were there right to the end of the war. So it was very heavy flak. Of course, I hadn't had much experience, but it seemed heavy to me anyway. And it was reported by crews afterwards, other crews, that they regarded it as very heavy. There were a lot of flashes in the sky. There were an enormous number of bomb bursts and some fires below. A lot of damage was done, but I suspect a lot of damage has already been done. But I do know that one of the German heavy cruisers was sunk.
But you didn't photograph it all. I mean, it wasn't part of your... You found that later.
Well, it was reported that they would fly a reconnaissance over the aircraft, over the target after the raid. Within a few hours, and they would photograph, and the photograph clearly showed that this vessel had turned turtle in the harbour.
Now, the other one was a night raid over Potsdam.
Yeah,
now, this
Potsdam.
Was this, you were carrying one, is it 8,000 or 5,000 bombs?
It's an 8,000.
Now, so that's just one. Now, what do you remember, again, just what were the aspects that marked this raid out for you?
Well, it's a long way for a start, because... Potsdam is to Berlin as, say, Richmond is to central London. It's sort of southwest. It's in the environs of Berlin. That area was still fairly heavily defended by Germany. Well, they always defended themselves. It was also, of course, the sort of headquarters of the old military cliche from... Well, the 19th century onwards, Potsdam was the center for the guys that had run Germany from that time onwards, and was regarded as the sort of headquarters of the German army. We were told it was important. The Russians had requested it, and it was thought that if this area was bombed heavily, the German army would lose some of its senior officers. That's what we were told. Whether they did, I don't know. It was a good trip in as much as it was long. It was very accurate. We were dead on time.
Now, hang on. You were in a bomber stream, though. Did that make it different? I mean, how different was it flying?
Oh, at night. A bomber stream at night.
Even three group. You wouldn't fly as a formation?
Oh, no, not at night, because you couldn't formate unless you had formation lights on. You didn't have to fly with lights on. No, you proceeded individually. You had a time on target. I mean, our squadron would be given the period to peer over the target. Might be between, 0010 to 0015. We had to be there within 5 minutes. Individual aircraft in the squadron were told to be there within that period or given a precise time. You couldn't always do this. I mean, if you were within 5 minutes, you were lucky.
You were flying higher as well, weren't you?
Yes, we
now
would.
Now, can you talk... I know you've got a little thing about the difficulty in getting the Lancaster at a certain height.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, the higher an aircraft goes, a normally aspirated engine, the more power it loses, and the less likely it is to be able to climb to altitude. This is helped by a supercharging system, which would enable you to get to heights and maintain power up to a certain height. But inevitably, once you're over about 15,000 feet, you lost quite a lot of power. So climbing the aircraft in a bomber stream at night, heavily laden, probably struggling along at about 140, 145 miles per hour to reach an altitude of, say, 20, 21, 22,000 feet, became quite a struggle. It would take an hour, hour and a half to do 10,000 feet climbing en route. Once at that height, you could feel the passage of other aircraft around you. The bomber stream, you know, could be up to 1,000, but more often was anything between 500, 800 aircraft, all trying to get on target within a 20-minute, 25-minute period, so that the skies were fairly clouded if the aircraft were all in the correct course and on the right in the stream. And what might happen is, you know, having laboriously climbed up to almost or at your height,
which would be
20,000.
This is much higher than the 16.5.
Oh, yes. This was high. The aircraft wasn't as maneuverable. It wallowed because it was heavily laden. It was high. The air was thin. You lost lift because of this. And then you might hit the slipstream of an aircraft in front, which would precipitate a dive down or a violent maneuver downward somewhere or other, with the wings going down left or right, and you'd lose quite a lot of height, sometimes 2,000 or 3,000 feet, before you could pull the aircraft out, slowly out, not violently, and then begin the whole system again, climbing back to height. And, you know, one would swear about this and moan, but it happened very, very often with the numbers of aircraft which were around you all the time. Then you would see the bomb aimer, who would be looking out through the front turret during the approach to the target, would see other aircraft in front. And he'd say, there's an aircraft just in front, Skip, slightly below, right, keep your eye on it, Stan. That sort of thing. The gunners might report aircraft to port or starboard or just below at the rear or just above us.
How real was the risk of collision in these circumstances?
Well, it's difficult to say because there are no, I think there are no statistics on collisions in midair at night. If you did collide, it was unlikely that anyone survived. Those that did would report a collision, but I think the majority of collisions went unreported because both crews would perish. The aircraft was just literally torn to pieces or explode. It seems to me almost impossible that there weren't a large number of collisions, because with a number of aircraft roughly the same height, within a 1,000 feet height band probably, converging on the same point in within 20 minutes, there were bound to be some mishaps. And it was just a recognized danger, but no one sort of quantified it. The other danger, of course, was aircraft above dropping their bombs through. This happened frequently. Aircraft got back with holes in them where bombs had just torn through. But, of course, many aircraft probably didn't get back. It's one of those things.
I mean, to compare it with the situation at Heathrow, regarded as a busy airport, I mean, yeah. But this is without lights and everything else.
Yes.
I mean, how crowded were the skies over the target, over something like Pops?
Well, over the target, on the approach to the target, very, very crowded. There might be 700 aircraft going over that target or in the vicinity of the target within 20 minutes. And you can just imagine that that's something like 35 to the minute, if that's my arithmetic, I think. 35 to the minute, you can just imagine that, all virtually in the same piece of airspace. It became very crowded.